Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by an absolutely intriguing character. He is the multiple award-winning magazine editor and brand consultant, Steve Beale. He's also at the moment the editorial director at Langford Crimson, the brand editing collective. He's also director of Battles of London, the world's only premium fightwear brand creating elite clothing for combat sport aficionados, whose custom-engineered athleisure garments reflect martial arts' revered status and admirable values. They promote combat sports as a positive lifestyle discipline that improves health, peace of mind, creativity, business, family, and friendships. Before this, he was a director of the Lazarides Gallery Group. For those of you who don't know them, I'm sure most of you do, they're the most influential art gallery of the 21st century. Before that, he was editor-in-chief of Fighters Only, the world's largest mixed martial arts magazine. And prior to that, he was senior editor of Arena, editor-at-large at The Face, when it really was The Face, and the editor of the spectacularly brilliant Sleaze Nation. So it just seems to me that Steve sort of seems to go in between either be doing stuff that's incredibly leading edge and or just sort of punching people randomly in the face. So, Steve, how are you?
Hey, Sean. Hey, I'm bearing up is probably the best way to put it. Just about emerging from the quagmire of ennui that that the lockdown has inspired within me.
Excellent. I emailed you saying, asking you to sort of be a guest on the podcast. One of the things you wanted to talk about was your point of view that sort of punching people in the face is the new ketamine. at which point I say, yeah, exactly, lockdown Britain.
It's a personal email, Sean. Screenshotting our WhatsApp conversations and using them for clickbait on your podcast.
Exactly. I do know someone who doesn't need punching in the face. Don't know if you've got a pen or not, but his address is 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C. He's a very large fringe man. So
he's a big fan of the Ultimate Fighting Championship. I don't know if you saw, but they actually had an event on Saturday and he sent a goodwill message in characteristic style.
Fantastic. So, but also we're just talking about the fact that I know at the moment you're in London, but you mentioned that you were in Spain in Ibiza when the Spanish lockdown kicked off. So, just talk us through that, because you mentioned you're a bit of a sort of time traveler. You were there when that was happening, but well, back here it was business as usual.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of coronavirus sob stories, I'd actually landed a fantastic new gig as the editor of an Ibiza-based well-being magazine, which was going absolutely great guns, combining as it did ecotourism and Kundalini serpent awakening ceremonies with, you know, still taking the odd pill. They'd had a tremendous amount of support from the businesses on the island, who are very, very keen that the whole place goes back to being a rich hippie paradise, which arguably is one of the inverted commas accelerated trends that we're going to see over the next few years. And, you know, I kind of needed a break from London anyway. And I was kind of thinking, you know, obviously, you know, let's not get into this, but London's not really the place it once was. And I was thinking, yeah, maybe move out. And I thought, this sort of rural paradise that also has fantastic culture might be a really good bet. And I wasn't the only one. And certainly with all the very sort of hypey features that I'd come up with, I flat planned 4 magazines and documented it quite exhaustively for the client. So right now I'm not exactly sitting on a untapped reservoir of creative energy that desperately needs to be unleashed to put on the post C19 world. I'm only just beginning to get a bit of enthusiasm back, to be honest. But yeah, what was happening in Ibiza was we were seeing things like the property market is different over there. Airbnb's bad. It's very difficult to rent out your holiday home. And so what we were seeing was people who had maybe made a bit of money and had a house on Ibiza deciding that they might as well move there to launch their new Eco Challenger brand, for example. And equally, we were also seeing tech companies, you know, the hallowed, deciding to locate to Ibiza to attract a certain kind of staff. And sure, if insurance companies are going to buy up Hoxton Square to attract a certain kind of staff, then it makes sense that tech companies are going to buy up bits of Ibiza to attract a certain kind of staff. So my big pitch for the magazine was that Ibiza is now a global center of ideas to rival Berlin, London, etc., having been at the cutting edge of both well-being and hedonism for the last 40 years. And I was very much willing to get settled into a new life of the cutting edge of well-being and hedonism. And unfortunately found it curtailed. And we sat there in the office and receiving phone calls from advertisers like W Hotels and Nobu saying, oh, we're not, you know, sure what's how these things are going to play out in the next few months, to be honest. And and then all of a sudden we were on lockdown, and then all of a sudden I was, you know, desperately trying to get a ticket for one of the last planes out, and came back here after doing about a week and a half of lockdown in Spain. And the Ibiza version of lockdown, of course, wasn't very characteristic, but it was very well-mannered. And I remember thinking, I bet London isn't as good at this. And and it wasn't quite so bad. But I came back here, and of course, everything was completely normal. And I felt like a time traveler who'd been sent back from the future to warn everyone about how grim it was going to be. And nobody was listening. And then, of course, it all went off again. And everyone, and I was just as guilty as this myself, was, you know, feeling a bit unhinged. I think we'll all look back at this period and say, yeah, there was definitely a few weeks there where I wasn't quite on point. And and went through all that as well. And you know, the oh my god, do we wash the Amazon package when it comes back, and all this kind of thing that's generally turning out to be possibly an overreaction. So it's been a wild ride, Sean, and I'm sat here. Obviously, I now have sort of one client, and I have Battles of London, I have the Side Hustle, and I can tell you about all the incredibly authentic things we've been doing to promote that in the last 6 weeks against the odds.
Exactly. So with one client.
I mean, I worked for, you just went over the career there. I was actually the fashion director of FHM as well, because I just don't want everyone to think that I'm some kind of arch cutting edge type person who has no respect for the mainstream. I actually loved working with the mainstream. I loved receiving actual letters from readers, which we did get at FHM, whereas we had to make them up at all the other magazines. And it was awesome. I think FHM sort of reminds me of social media a bit, because at FHM, most magazines sell proportionately more inside the M25. In fact, all magazines sell proportionately more inside the M25. FHM sold proportionately more outside the M25. And we did very well with subject matter, like, you know, those Essex gangster movies and customizing your car and things, all these kind of things that Londoners find exceptionally distasteful, but everyone else thinks is great fun. And that's slightly tight. Obviously, as a print journalist, I can't abide social media, and I hate the sort of oppressive nature of the obligation to do it. But what I do slightly admire about influencers and stuff like that is the way they're stood there looking incredibly glamorous in a suburban garden. And it reminds me of High Street Honeys. Remember when we had High Street Honeys in FHM? So that's the one the one bit of faith I have in social media is that way. It's like a mainstream expression that is sort of ignored by the establishment.
Nice. You've made talking there about things like FHM as opposed to things like The Face. God, I always remember years ago when remember Phil, who used to publish The Face, he asked me to go down and just talk to the staff, to the editorial team, about youth culture because he thought they'd lost their way. And I've never given a talk where the audience hated me so much, you know, literally the contempt and loathing on the sort of on the staff's face. It's like, get out. But me and we're talking earlier on about obviously the reality of lockdown Britain. When you're not taking ketamine, you're growing your hair. So you're saying that we're all going to look like sort of Robinson Crusoe at tribal gathering at 5 a.m.
No. I think we should all keep our lockdown haircuts. Yes, for at least the first rave back. It is, as my mother says, a strange time, and I think we're all pretty nervous about what sort of world of work we're going to come back to, really, aren't we? I've got a friend who's a graphic designer who worked out that if him and his wife, who works with him, and the two teenage boys all went to work at Sainsbury's, they'd probably be better off. And they could come home at 5 o'clock in all their brown Sainsbury's clothes. However, my younger brother tells me firsthand that stacking supermarket shelves is no joke. So, a degree of nervousness. Normally in this kind of situation, I would be that terribly annoying little finger type guy who would be going, oh, chaos is a ladder. And, oh, yeah, the people that are strong now are the ones that will emerge. I would normally be that guy, but I was just too exhausted after all the work I've been doing. Yeah, so be that person, maybe thankfully.
So, and from the point of view of, the sort of where things are going to go, is it going to be a case of, you know, everything must be created anew? Is it going to be, as you're saying, so this real moment of, as you're just saying, sort of a creative explosion, or actually another way, is it a moment of absolute sort of a retrenching and desperate fear, scrabbling for the... to get the last helicopter out of Saigon.
Yeah, in terms of the creative industries and brands, you think? The article from sort of my sector that's been held up as something worth reading was from the editor of a wonderful women's magazine called Riposte, which is one of these actually sophisticated and intelligent women's magazines that people have tried to do for decades. And now, I'm glad to say, have become very successful. And she wrote a piece just about what a fantastic position they were in before all this hit, and a bit similar to what I've just been saying about Native, the magazine in Ibiza. Getting the phone calls about the cancellations for the brand collaborations and things like that. Yeah. And she wrote a rather wonderful article about how she admires anyone who's full of energy and is sort of fighting against a C-19 nightmare. But she right now she's just going to sort of sit back and take stock. And I think we should maybe all be allowed to have whatever reaction we need to have to all this. One reaction, of course, you mentioned it, is the conspiracy theories. I work a little bit with a psychologist called Dr. Stephen Blumenthal, who's the UK's number one expert on toxic male behavior. And he wrote, for example, he wrote the article in The Observer about Rolf Harris when Rolf Harris was taken away.
Yeah.
And that things like this. And he thinks it's fascinating, the sort of democratization of the conspiracy theory and the way David Icke has suddenly found a number of new adherents who might have been might have leaned towards more the champagne socialist side of things beforehand, and since their mastery of the universe have been threatened, have become fans of David Icke. And what I loved was when Eamon Holmes and Amanda Holden and everyone like that got on the 5G conspiracy theory. And the way the 5G conspiracy theory has become the most democratized sort of conspiracy theory ever. And there you have Eamon Holmes sort of trying to be a sort of budget Facebook version of Piers Morgan by latching onto it. And I think as people who work with trends, I find some of the most delicious arcs, as it were, is when an idea starts off as part of the extreme fringe and ends up being retweeted by Amanda Holden. I find that very funny. And Banksy, of course, is a great example of this. And I just edited, actually, the Steve Lazaridis book, the Capturing Banksy book, with the pictures of the early work and the pictures of Banksy at work. And I think maybe let's call it Banksyfication, this sort of popularization of a previously extreme trend. And I mean, personally, I'd love to believe in conspiracy theories. I mean, it's terribly exciting. But as someone with an overactive sense of humor, I take even more comfort from the notion that the world is really more like The Thick of It or Red Dwarf. And I see people like you saying, you know, what is the culture going to come up with as an answer to C19? And what I'm desperate to see is a sort of Netflix irreverent sitcom set in the Illuminati, where sort of every episode ends with them just about succeeding in not being uncovered. And maybe you could have Frankie Boyle making a cameo each episode as the leader of the space lizards. culturally wise, I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because we've all seen these sort of DJs live streaming, and you had the Hacienda live stream, and it was basically like clubbing with all the good bits taken out. And I think culture is still to give something, to offer something up about this situation. And it equally, we've heard a lot recently, haven't we, about sort of content overload and brand overload. And I thought it was interesting how the amount of people streaming music has actually gone down, which they think is partly to do with the commute and just not having that spike when everyone uses their smartphones during the commute. But subscriptions, for example, for Spotify have actually gone up. So you've got more people signing on for these things, but less, you know, less actual use of them. And I think it is that sort of almost sort of onanistic interaction with culture, where we just sit there and, you know, the extreme end of that is the scrolling feed, the scroll down feed, where we just sit there and are sort of force fed slop. I hope that's dying a little bit. And it's more as people getting back, for example, sort of craft and hobbies is a very interesting one, because of course hobbies were just so unfashionable for years and years. I blame Stevie Wonder, of course, and his Pastime Paradise record, and having a hobby was just, and then they sort of came back, didn't they? But they had to be a lifestyle trend. So you could be into ping pong, But you weren't just allowed to be into ping pong. You had to go to the hipster ping pong place and take photos of yourself doing it on Instagram. And then it wasn't a hobby anymore. It was, a London thing. And hobbies are, of course, coming back, by storm. And I hate to come on a intelligent podcast like this and quote, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. But isn't there something in there about how hobbies help rebuild testosterone, which of course we all need, men and women, for the world of work? And maybe that's what this period has been, is a chance for us all to build back up some testosterone, because it sounds like we're gonna need it in the next 20 years. And we can all talk about economic impact and all this. And as someone who's lived through the last 10 years of wage depreciation and clients saying, oh, we haven't got much budget and, oh, you'll have to do all the work and then we'll release the product. And if and when the product makes money, maybe you'll get paid. Sorry, we didn't tell you that when we commissioned you in the first place. As someone who's sort of lived through that for 10 years, I'm not looking forward to the next 20 if they're going to be like that.
Fair one. To say on a happier note, going back slightly, your point about sort of humor, I thought fantastic that you mentioned Rolf Harris. I do remember that great one had when I was working in the wonderful world of Adland and Black Grape, because he did a lot of work in the music industry. So I think MCA with a label that Black Grape were on, and they wanted an ad. So we said, how about getting Rolf Harris in? We'll trick Rolf Harris into being in a Black Grape ad. So we said to him, what you want to do is to have Rolf Harris dressed as Jason King in Jason's King sort of, you know, sort of plush office. Yeah. So we said we'd build the studio in the back of a truck, put it outside his house. So all he had to do was walk down his damn pathway, get into this truck wearing a sort of a velvet jacket. And then,
of course, everyone's careers depended on this happening, of course.
Precisely. Yeah. Yeah, we're going to pay him 40 grand for doing it. I mean, you know, hello. And then all was going well because he said, who are Black Grape? We're going, you know, oh, they're a nice popular band. All was going well to actually find out who Sean Ryder was, and the whole thing rather unraveled. But there we are. Lesson for us all.
A classic, yes. So, don't tell him what we actually do and what we're actually like. Yeah.
Never tell the truth was the first thing I was told in advertising, and an excellent one, has to live by that. But in terms of going back to where you started off, because I think that this story is so interesting, because it's so unusual and sort of whatever, fresh and honest. So,
chaotic.
Go on, utter chaos, obviously. So, go on, try and make it sound as it was all planned out. But so talk us through, for anyone who doesn't remember the late great Sleaze Nation, tell us what that was all like when
It's having a bit of a moment right now, isn't it? Wonderland did a big feature about Sleaze Nation, and I think Law Magazine, which is the sort of equivalent of Sleaze Nation these days in the sense that it's the slightly more sort of artistic and left field of the style mags. I think they did a poster recently now. And I see Sleaze Nation. I was 22, 23 when I did Sleaze Nation. And I kind of see it as an early work, shall we say. I mean, that Banksy book I just edited, a lot of those photos of Banksy's early work hasn't been seen recently because artists don't like people to see their early work. And I kind of see Sleaze Nation as a bit of an early work, and I'm a little bit embarrassed by it, to be honest. I'm not embarrassed about all the wonderful people who started out there, like, you know, Joanne Furniss, Alistair McClellan, Ewan Spencer, Jonathan DeVillier, Justin Quill. I mean, the list is very long. But it was a long time ago. Elements of it certainly did become the new orthodoxy. It was like a sort of missing link between Dazed and Confused and Vice, and that area seems to be where the style press as a whole resides at the moment. Sleaze Nation, wonderful time. I mean, a friend of the old music editor of Sleaze Nation is the editor of the Investors Chronicle, the Financial Times' investment magazine. And he said he went for an interview at the Financial Times, and they said, oh, there's a bit of a blank spot here on your CV. And he said, oh, yeah, I was the music editor of this sort of little style magazine. They said, which one? And he said, Sleaze Nation. And they said, oh, you've got the job. And it sort of comes up with alarming regularity. No one really wants to know about the huge amounts of money that I made a corporation at FHM using style magazine tactics to entice mainstream advertisers. But they all want to talk about Sleaze Nation. And that's it. People keep saying you should start it again, but I'm not. I don't know. Let these things rest.
Oh, Steve, do it. I remember. Yeah, guys, because I remember writing for it, and I found the epic sort of an issue in front of me actually back in November 1999 with a brilliant cover by Designers Republic when I wrote about the J18 riots, the first big sort of anti-capitalist riot before the anti-WTO riots in Seattle. Yeah, very good.
My word, we're just so ahead of our time.
We certainly were. As I said, the only way soul can truly reveal itself is through direct action, pleaded the Dadaist art movement. It looks like it's written by a really annoying sort of fifth former. So that
old
was
magazine, though, so it's written by a really annoying fifth former. Our print magazines, a loser of C19, is a question, I think. Are they a winner or a loser? And because, of course, before this, we were looking at a sort of return to tactile products a bit, whether that was vinyl records or whether it was print magazines. And I don't know if you want to get into this, but we do a print magazine for Battles of London, my premium fightwear brand. And it's one of those magazines that you buy in the specialist magazine shops, and it only comes out once in a blue moon, and and it looks more like an art book. And I had to be slightly talked into doing that by everyone involved. And I can honestly say that it has been a far more successful brand extension in the sense that we charge money for it. So, on the one hand, it's marketing, but on the other hand, we get money back from it than anything else we've done. Anything. I'm talking like social media influencing, sponsoring events, things like that. Now, that is maybe partly to do with the fact that there is not a design-led magazine for boxing and mixed martial arts and martial arts like there is for everything else. And when we were researching it, we found two different design-led carp fishing magazines. just like talking about Sleaze Nation and style magazines and just how difficult it was making style magazines in the 1990s when everyone else was covering that subject matter. I think how the style magazine industry has moved on is it's about applying those production values to subjects that don't normally get that sort of treatment. And maybe it's less so about sort of discos in war zones and this rapper called Little So and So and all that. It's that's what I think is the most exciting part of print magazines is where people are putting high production values onto subjects that haven't normally received them, and it's got to be one of the most galling things about C19 that the one of the biggest winners is probably going to be big technology, isn't it?
Yeah, and totally. I mean, 100%.
Especially in particular, Amazon. And you mentioned the gentleman at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and I'm sort of wistfully remembering when Sam Harris had Trump's biggest opponent on the right on his podcast, and Sam Harris, who hates Trump, his first question was, what, if anything, has Donald Trump done right? And the guest, he mostly talked about challenging China about how it plays fast and loose with World Trade Organization rules, but he also alluded to taking on Amazon and how Trump has said about Amazon, look, it's literally taking tax dollars out of America and money off people's bank balances. And what my experience with Amazon, my defining experience with Amazon working with them, was at Lasrides at the gallery when we wanted to get in 20 copies of an artist's new book to sell on the website. The artist publishing company said, you can buy them cheaper from Amazon individually than we can sell them to you wholesale. Okay. Now, so essentially what Amazon were doing there was making a little loss so they could price others out of the market. Now, whatever you think about the morality of that, whether you think that's just business, everything in reality, that I think there's it's there's some sort of funny money going on in there, isn't there? And I think what we know about all these sort of funny money things, whether it's WeWork quite recently or whether it's the 2008 financial crisis, is they never end well. And if that one ends well, then my name is Elon Musk. So and then of course there's social media, and I think when we look at tech and what we do and don't like about tech, it's kind of worth sort of picking it apart, especially if we're gonna probably have to live with it. Is more like what do we do and we don't like about tech. And you know, obviously I'm going to make lots of jokes about social media as a print journalist, but I actually quite enjoy doing it. And I have to say to clients, look, if you want me to spend all day creating and publishing content, sure, but trust me, it's a waste of time. not a waste of time at all. But these days they're going to have to boost it, for example, and boosting a content post isn't necessarily what you do, blah, blah, blah. And when I think about, you know, what I don't like about tech, what I don't like about tech, it isn't really social media itself. It's more, A, the sort of tyranny of chasing the numbers. And perhaps that the conversations you have to have around chasing the numbers, where everyone who's in the know knows that it's done by, inverted commas, dark arts, whether that is the follow unfollow thing or the, you know, the latest thing is the mass story engager. Do you know about this? Cool. Are we allowed to lift the curtain on things like this? The mass story engager is basically a bot that that looks at other people's Instagram stories for you, right? And with the millions and millions that it's able to look at, some of them will be the kind of Instagram user, and, you know, and there's lots of them that go, oh, look, a brand has looked at me. I'll follow them back. And you just do millions and millions and millions of those, and you get the number, you get your numbers up. And so the sort of chasing the algorithm side of things, and the way it plays with your emotions. A friend of mine who used to work for the Zuckerberg empire said, remember, Steve, the most powerful algorithms are the ones that compel you to make the content. So forget about everything else. The actual algorithms that we should be thinking about are the ones that are compelling us to make content. And there's a reason why when you start your business Instagram account, you get tons of engagement and it slowly drops off. And you think to yourself, how do I get that back? And the answer really is either make tons and tons of content, which is essential for the Zuckerberg business model, or pay to distribute that content, which is essential for the Zuckerberg business model. And I sometimes think I work for Mark Zuckerberg because I'm here sort of creating content for his platform and then paying to advertise alongside the content. It's like paying to advertise in my own magazine. And it's such a fantastic business model. And I think it's the sort of tyranny of that. And just having to explain to people who aren't such sort of experienced users how it's a bit more complicated than it looks. And it's probably about fiddling or paying more than anything else is the difficult thing. And and will it carry on? I mean, I don't know. I think the fascinating thing about social media, particularly sort of user-generated content, brand-generated content, is it's all very location-based. And those you'd have to have a heart of stone, I think, not to laugh at the way that that has all been taken away. And in terms of what sort of brands, you know, sort of authentic brands and things like this should be doing, and, you know, I thought, well, goodness, I don't know. I think it's definitely down to individual cases. And I think a lot of the suspicion around business motives comes from actually working for those businesses. And what we've all, you know, experienced a business, worked at a business, large or small, that preaches altruism, whether that's internally or externally, while being a bit more practically minded, should we say, about things like free overtime or paying invoices. And what we all know by now that the call center is not, after all, for our benefit and things like that. So it, I think all brands are very much on the sort of back foot in terms of motives and communicating that they supposedly have, pure motives. And what I suppose, but what have we been doing with Battles of London? And of course, we've been totally stuck because combat sports is all about very close participation. And I'm not sure what it says about me that all these things I write about are about sort of close participation. And this is before we get onto the fact that the creative industries has moved very much towards, live events and participation, because it's about the only thing that you can charge money for these days. So the creative industry, and so it's really a sort of perfect storm in that regard. And what we do with our brand is that there's a lot of content marketing around the sport. So sort of what happened at the event this weekend, and we angle it very much more towards participation and health and fitness and nutrition and mindset and all these things. And we're quite one sort of happy accident is because all the fighters we work with as a result are sort of Renaissance men. Well, we do have all these pictures of them wearing the gear, oil painting and tending their allotments and things like this, which of course, as anyone who works with social media knows, normally go down like a lead balloon because they're not a clear message of a guy in a cage punching someone in the face. But they've actually come in very, very handy in the last couple of months. They look really appropriate. So that's good news. And obviously we've made a lot of appropriate and informative content. We had a great feature from one of the commentators at one of the events that took place behind closed doors with no audience and, all the corner men wearing masks and things like this. We had a immune system optimization diet and supplement stack if you don't want to eat any vegetables. So I think just doing sort of appropriate things, having a good think about how appropriate that they are is the best thing to do, and judging the mood in that way. I think if I'm going to sort of push over a sacred cow, t-shirts that sort of give money to the NHS and stuff. I think the horrible news is you'll get away with that if it's a good t-shirt. And you won't if it isn't, is I'm afraid that the sort of rather cynical truth about that. As an aside, for the first time in so long, the other day I heard somebody, and this guy was a very clued up, very admired figure within his sector who had his own brand, and he's about mid-30s. He's not as old as us, Sean. And he said to me, "Oh, I don't like it when brands do a sponsored post because I don't think it's cool." And I thought, that is the first time in goodness knows how long that I have heard somebody equate shameless promotion with not being cool or authentic or anything like that. And I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this, but remember, Sean, when it was all about the quality of the audience that you attracted and not about just the sort of, the millions of people who are probably in some other country and have nothing to do with your audience, let alone maybe part of your audience. And is it ever going to go back to that? I don't know. When I put together a social media advertising campaign for my clients, I wish there was a box I could tick that said this will only go to educated, wealthy professionals of a certain age. So maybe it's going to come back sooner rather than later. I did notice that you can't advertise to people over a certain age on LinkedIn anymore. Is that just one of those things that they're just trying out or something like that? Who knows? Let's get back to C19.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, on that, I mean, and as all, I mean, just really, really fascinating. Because I was going to then ask you about sort of, you know, the similarities or differences between running something that is on one side, you say the sort of Dalston friendly cutting edge, as in something like Sleaze, as opposed to we were talking earlier on about, you know, the inner M25. Out of 25 FHM angle, and sort of what it's like then running something like Battles of London. But what about, you mentioned the other day this whole thing about, you know, facetious or not, but, you know, post C19, you're saying, is the countryside the new Shoreditch?
Well, I've got a sort of personal interest in this because I actually grew up in a town in the West Country called Portishead, which is of the, you know, and obviously the band of the same name are from there. And, you know, I feel their pain. And it's a very unremarkable sort of retirement town. And that part of the West Country, it's a bit sort of rural noir. It's not the Cotswolds. It's not the Yorkshire Dales. It's not the Lake District. It's motorbike accidents and and things like that. And Portishead has become, because of obviously property investment, things like that, Britain's first hipster small town. Wow. And with people deciding they're going to live there rather than Bristol. And when we all grew up in Bristol, we used to read about how trendy it was in ID magazine and think it's not really like that just yet. And and since it has become a bit like that, because all the wannabe skateboarders and dope smokers and drum and bass producers read about how Bristol was a mecca for that kind of thing and went to university there or went to live there. So now it is a bit like that. And people who are looking at it and go, oh my God, let's live in Portishead. And there's a marina there, which is supposed to look like Marina Botafoc in Ibiza. And it's kind of really taken off. And of course, in the 80s, what I gather is, in the 70s, there was a similar sort of level of metropolitan living to today, and then a lot of companies were given tax breaks to move outside of London, and that slightly stimulated the rush to the country then. And you know, will that happen again now? And of course, Sean, there were all kinds of people who we'd call sort of opinion formers doing this, you know, for the last few years, isn't it? That they've, 1 minute I am campaigning for Jeremy Corbyn in Stoke Newington. The next minute I seem to have moved into my deceased parents' house in Hampshire. And here's my man cave and business as usual. And I don't blame anyone for doing that right now. And it's the right now, really, that seals the deal. And are we going to go back to sort of large living areas? And does that mean that maybe things like books, records, print magazines, painting your own art, things like this, is actually going to come back in? And this idea that we have all our entertainment hobbies within the computer screen and that's okay, is maybe that might not be so popular anymore. Mm. And I have to say, look at Ibiza. There's a reason why that people are moving there, basing themselves there. It's like Shoreditch on sea. I think that's going to be the new place to live. I mean, we've all sat here in London as London became a terrible victim of its own success. And I personally have been compelled to think that the economic ecosystem wants the very same mindset that gentrified Shoreditch to actually move elsewhere and do the same thing to other towns. Mm-hmm. And I quite gleefully saw that Sheffield might well emerge as the eminent hipster northern city. I lived in Newcastle myself for a year, editing Fighters Only. I was dreading it. It was absolutely fantastic. I could tell you endless amusing stories about how cheap the rent was and things like that. And, you know, I was going to buy a 4x4 because that was how I was living up there. And down here, I'm just another East London media loser. And, and but I think it's going to take a long time, though. I think it's going to take a long time.
Okay, I say on that, by the way, just talking about Sheffield, I remember a while ago there's a brilliant thing on Radio 6. It's a good couple of years ago, and Jarvis Cocker was giving a guide to Sheffield, where he grew up, obviously, with the Mighty Pulp. And so he just took a rowing boat down the River Don, and he described it as being like a sort of poor man's apocalypse now. Absolutely fantastic. But on that, I mean, in terms of the West Country and Portishead and Bristol, the rest of it, I mean, I also think it's very interesting is that West Country has always, you know, had a real... You know, the aura of sort of anarchy was never that far away. I mean, you know, they always had that. The whole Cornish thing has always been, obviously, you know, apart from the annoying sort of London types going down there for the second homes. But you've got, you know,
My dad has a T-shirt. My dad has a T-shirt with the Cornish flag on the back, and that the word that the sort of dialect for over in Cornish is scat, and on the front of the T-shirt it says farming scat, fishing scat. Back to wrecking Mahartys, and that's kind of how they feel down there. And is it? It's basically, well, it's got that, it's that slightly Brighton thing, dare I say it, Sean, where it's a bit sort of cheaper to live and have a bohemian lifestyle, isn't it? And obviously, I sort of grew up amongst sort of the crusties and, you know, buying dope off the Travellers and Glastonbury Festival. So I'm possibly not as kind of inclined to think that it's all rainbows and unicorns as maybe some others are. But it is, I hope it's gradually, but I've always felt that Bristol was a bit of a disappointment, really, but and compared to the media image of it, but it does seem to be realizing itself, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. But I was saying it was interesting, I was talking about this the other day, that Jerusalem, the play of the century so far, obviously by Jez Butterworth, with the great Mark Rylance starring it when it came out before it went off to Broadway, is going to come back next year. Obviously, it had already been booked in before this whole, but the whole pandemic took off. But that was naturally all about, you know, this semi-mythical character down in the West Country who is drawing sort of miscreants and the outsiders around him. And
it sounds awesome. Awesome. I'm ashamed to say that I had not heard of it.
Oh my God, Steve gets up down. The Jerusalem was, I mean, yeah, renowned as being certainly the play of the decade when it came out about 10 years ago, right. And it touched on a load of things. And yeah, sort of the mythology of the West Country, the other world dealers and crusties and Glastonbury.
Yeah, exactly. I have to book a ticket straight away. I've obviously been watching far too much cage fighting. But you just have to be so immersed these days, don't you? You have to be so immersed in everything, partly because of social.
Mm-mm. So again, so last sort of a few things. It's been super interesting, Steve. So in terms of, you also have a very interesting take on things, and you mentioned right at the beginning about sort of, you know, talking with psychologists about where it's all going. I remember talking with the head of the Tavistock Centre, the largest sort of psychoanalytical centre in the UK, about, you know, where the UK was. This is a while ago, and he always had an incredibly interesting sort of view on the zeitgeist of, you know, reading between the lines. So in terms of sort of looking back a year from now, putting you on the spot, so how do you think things are going to play out over the next 12 months from a UK point of view?
About that time, about a year ago, a bit more, I was on the panel of judges for the Dazed and Confused Brexit Photography Competition. And we were all chosen because our work concerns the more radical elements within British subculture, which I was rather pleased with. And so it was me, Jeremy Deller, and then loads of sort of art noise type DJs and other sort of confrontational characters. And in the blurb for the photo I chose, I said that I was sick to death of the culture war, and I was ready to bang both sides' heads together, given the first opportunity. And I think one of the reliefs of being in Ibiza was getting away from that a little bit. And I wonder how much we've been, inverted commas, exposed to it in Britain, and whether we have any sort of post-traumatic stress disorder from it all. Mm. And I think, I'm the kind of person, maybe I should be clear. Yes, I voted Remain. No, I do not vote Conservative. But the whole thing exhausts me, and I find it very oppressive, both sides of it. I live in East London now, so I get the wokeness, and I grew up in, you know, a very sort of conservative West Country environment. So I've seen the other side as well. I don't like that either. Mm. And, this culture war, which we all thought had kind of dissipated maybe after the election, it seems to be have a, maybe it's like a virus, Sean. It seems to be able to find new fronts to open effortlessly. And of course, the latest front in the culture war is between, you know, people that think lockdown should end and people that think it should sort of continue indefinitely. But we should probably all have like sort of NHS rainbows tattooed on our foreheads. And I did laugh, by the way, about how the contact tracing app that may or may not beep when you've been outside for too long was going to be an NHS app. Because who could possibly turn down downloading the NHS app, Sean? Yeah, you've got your NHS app, have you? Surely, yes, yes. I'm not conspiracy theory minded, but that did really make me think twice about the NHS app. And as a historian someone with a history degree, I should be able to identify another period, probably in Roman times or something, but when the public discourse was between the neurotic and the obnoxious, for want of another term, and I can't think of it, and I'm not particularly optimistic now about when it's going to end all that, and I don't know. I mean, one of my clients is Forge & Co., the thriving independent co-working space, which is run by a lot of people that used to, well, still do run Boyzone, the original lifestyle brand, Sean, which was started by Andrew Weatherall, rest his soul, and Terry Farley and Simon Eccle, who's the chap behind Forge & Co. and various others. And from the start, what they wanted to do was take what they'd learned in clubs and apply it to offices, which sounds a bit incongruous, but at the end of the day meant just a nice restaurant. You know how you'll go to a WeWork or something and it's supposed to be very modern, but actually the canteen is more like a sort of student canteen. So they had a nice restaurant and, you know, roof terrace, and it was all about environment. And I'm very glad to say that the articles that people keep sending me on Medium, etc., are down with that, that they are saying that the office in the future will be more about creating an environment. And what's interesting about all this sort of working from home stuff is those of us who work in co-working, we already know that people don't actually want to be at home all the time. And it's a bit like, you know, people go to bloody Starbucks rather than sit at home all the time. And it's a bit like what I said about sort of unpicking tech. Let's actually be very clear about the details of what we do and don't like at the moment about the office. And don't get me wrong, I think kids in the future will be shown Pathé News footage of the rush hour at school and will just go, what were they doing? What were they thinking? What was that about? But at the same time, I think people do still like to go to an HQ, but we know for sure with all the evidence from online gaming and stuff that people love combining their skills in a team in the way that they don't often get to do in the obfuscated corporate workplace. So And Forge & Co., I can say, have had a surprising number of inquiries about offices in the last few months. Mm-hmm. And so what we've done a big report about it, and what we're looking at doing is providing solutions to companies that need to adjust to the inverted commas new world of work. And did a bit of research on that, and spoke to a couple of friends who are sort of super high up, sort of operations directors, finance directors, etc., at sort of enormous companies. And one of the interesting things they said was that they were kind of terrified about what's the right word for them? Junior staff. I want to call them greens, like in that book, Surrounded by Idiots. Have you read that? The management book.
Where are the greens?
The ones who do the sort of rank and file work. That they were terribly worried about what if the greens would do any work from home, and they're still concerned about whether they're going to work from home once the restrictions are lifted a little bit. But they said it's gone a lot better than they thought it was going to. Mm-hmm. Which I personally am a bit surprised by as well. Mm-hmm. So I think essentially to be a bit more concise, what we're looking at is a sort of workplace which is like a hub which people come to sort of 2 or 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe avoiding the rush hour. And I think what people have got sick of is just the sort of relentless nature of the contemporary. I was going to call it 9 till 5, but of course it's not, is it? It's 9 till 8. And the sort of interminable after work drinks, which Tom Ford, the fashion designer, blames London's after work drinks culture for his own alcoholism. And the bake-offs and the birthdays. And it's all this kind of thing I was reading that people are sort of relieved not to have to go through that sort of office culture where because of long hours, because of weekend working, the sort of HR crews have decided that the best way to balance that is with after work drinks. And honestly, that's what we're looking at. We're looking at a lot less office social. Mm. We're looking at the office being a hub where you go in sort of 2 or 3 days a week. And we're looking at avoiding the rush hour. And I think everyone's going to be pretty happy with that. And I hope it happens. I hope we're all not working in Sainsbury's.
Mm. There we are, Steve. Well, exactly. And on that happy note, that's great. We covered some serious ground there, from Robinson Crusoe haircuts at Tribal Gathering through Ibiza lockdowns, and you coming back from Ibiza with a view on what was going to happen, and no one really realizing where it's going to go. By the way, when's the Banksy book out that you've done?
It's been out for a few months. I think you can almost certainly buy the latest inverted commas limited edition. Where you might get the opportunity to get it. There may be a sort of golden ticket kind of type thing in there, one of those Diana faced £10 notes, so you can join the queue of resellers for that. Nice. Yeah, we know from talking about hype fashion. I know from the art world that whole kind of printing stuff for people to resell, that ends badly as well. Just so you know, in the brand fashion stakes.
Awesome. Steve, that is absolutely brilliant. Well, thank you, because it was a really, really interesting run through a ton of stuff there. Particularly near the end there, the issue about the culture wars now coming down to the neurotic versus the obnoxious. So,
It is the unspeakable in pursuit of the uneatable.
Well, there we are. Very good. Steve Beale, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Sean.
And also, Steve, before you go, obviously, please do remind me and the listeners where they can track you down.
If you're into boxing, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, Muay Thai, mixed martial arts, you need right now to get on battlesoflondon.com. You can follow us as well at Battles of London. You want to get in with the new world of work. You want to get over to Forge & Co. We're at forgeandco.co.uk, at Forge & Co., of course. You want to find out about rural utopias and then get onto Native Magazine. That's NATIV. Social media and smartphones are becoming more and more non-new in Ibiza, so you might have to actually get a print copy of that. But that there are still some knocking around, certainly you can get in touch.
Fantastic. All of those, consider it done. So, Steve, that is brilliant. Thanks a lot.
Cheers, Sean.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.